May it please the court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Deon Black. Mr. Black was convicted of possession with intent to deliver cocaine and possession within 300 feet of a church after the jury, without knowledge of either of the parties, considered information that was improperly obtained by a single juror and that went to a central issue at trial, and the individual from whom it was obtained was not aware of all the facts, was not under oath, and was not subject to cross-examination. Therefore, Mr. Black's right to an impartial jury was violated, and his convictions must be reversed. Even if one deliberating juror is influenced by an outside source, an individual's right to an impartial jury is violated. As long as there's jury misconduct and either actual or presumptive prejudice, there is cause for reversal. Actual prejudice is shown through evidence that at least one juror was actually influenced, and presumptive prejudice is established through egregious circumstances.
Is it your position that the outside information, that there was new information within that that tipped the scale, or just the fact that the son corroborated what the officer said and that tipped the scale?
Well, first of all, it doesn't matter for presumptive prejudice purposes. We don't have to establish that it tipped the scale one way or the other. It did corroborate the state's case, which is prejudicial to Mr. Black, yes. Also, the outside informant, for lack of a better word, was not under oath, so we don't know if he was telling the truth. He was not subject to cross-examination. In other words, it wasn't.
By that, you mean the son?
Yes, I'm sorry. So it wasn't tested by the adversarial system. And that's the problem with the outside information. Does that answer?
I think so. We do know, though, that before the son's information was injected into the jury room, at least three or more jurors had difficulty with the credibility of the state's expert witness.
Correct.
And after the son's information is injected into the jury room, they accept the state's position.
That's correct. And so the argument is that there was actual prejudice, but even if the court does not find actual prejudice, there's presumptive prejudice, and the state cannot show that it was harmless.
Can you answer the question for me about whether the trial judge, in his inquiry of juror number three, we'll call him father, juror number three's revelation to the jury about by those number of baggies he has to be selling, purportedly information from the expertise within his own family, that the trial judge actually made inquiry of anyone other than the father about how it affected their verdict?
No, he did not. In fact, that...
Why not? I mean, as Justice Ritchie just pointed out, the records suggest that there was more to this than just whether the father's verdict was influenced
right.
by what the son said. But purportedly, he announced his son's findings of fact or expert opinion to the entire jury, and there were two others that were hung for some reason after the first day, but we don't know why
right.
necessarily. But why wasn't that inquiry made?
Your Honor, it's not clear from the record why it was not done. However, it is evidence of an abuse of discretion by the trial court that he did not inquire into those jurors. Because that.
But I'm correct in my assumption from the record that the inquiry ended when the father said, no, it didn't have any influence on what I thought.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
But it didn't touch on what the other two may have thought.
The other two undecided.
Other two jurors.
Undecideds, yes. That's correct. He did not address that. And, in fact, that's why, at the very least, there's presumptive prejudice, because, first, he couldn't even rule out, actually, that the father was not influenced. The court found that the son had little, if any, influence on the father. So,
well, doesn't that acknowledge that there was some?
That's exactly right. And so that's actual prejudice.
And wasn't there at least an issue raised about this same juror asking his wife how to decide the case?
There was some confusion, I think, factually, in the argument that Mr. Black raises is based on the court's finding of fact. But what happened was the juror, and these aren't their exact, these are the labors they were given later, but juror number one told the court that juror number two had talked to her roommate, and she thought that influenced her decision. So they called juror number two in, who said, no, I only told my roommate that I was in a criminal case. But juror number three said he talked to his wife, and I think that may have influenced his decision. So juror number three came in, and he said, no, I didn't talk to my wife. I talked to my son, because he's a recovering heroin addict, and he gave me information that if they have that many baggies, which indicates he told them the facts of the case, it's for sale. So the court didn't, the finding of the court wasn't that he actually talked to his wife. So based on the findings of the court, it appears that he only talked to his son about this, and that juror number two may have been an error.
But he also identified that the issue for the father, juror number three, was whether or not there was sufficient evidence of intent to deliver as opposed to simple possession.
That's correct.
And it's a reasonable inference that that might well have held up a guilty verdict by one or more other jurors, but we just don't know.
That's correct. Actually, what the father testified to was he said he originally he said you know, who's to say that who's to say that the fellow didn't hand that, being the drugs, to him, and he hid it under a tree to take it home later on to party with. That was his mindset, at least before he went home the first day, and that, quite frankly, was consistent with the defendant's argument. It was disputed, the intent to deliver, where the attorney argued that this is similar to if you have 24 cans of beer, doesn't mean you intend to sell the beer. You may be intending to use it later on. So his thinking was consistent along those lines. And no, it wasn't very specific what the other two or three were hung on. He did indicate that me and a couple others were what was holding things up. And the fact that the next day he told the entire jury this indicates that this was an issue they were all possibly interested in.
Was possession conceded or an issue at trial?
I'm sorry.
Simple possession?
Was not conceded, no. In fact, the defendant put on several witnesses who said they never saw him with the drugs. They never saw him interact with a gentleman with an orange sweatshirt who was the alleged purchaser. And the client took the stand and denied being the person that the cops were looking at. So that was, in fact, contested. Also, the distance between the tree and the church was contested by the defense counsel as well. So all the issues were contested at different levels. So while the jury may not, while it's not clear from the record what exactly the other two or three juries were hung on, and while the state may seem to think that possession was clear, that was an issue in dispute, so both convictions should be reversed. Does the court have any other questions?
What was the time frame of the judge's inquiry of the jurors and the verdict?
The time frame was, the first one I think was almost immediately, shortly thereafter. Let me see.
That's the inquiry of juror number two?
Juror number one. Juror number two, I apologize. The verdict came down on, July 2nd, and then the first hearing was July 29th. Then on August 13th, they brought that same juror back in to identify a picture of juror number three. And then it wasn't until October 10th that they got the third juror in, and that was, I think, we were having a hard time getting him to come in.
It's been a while since I've been in a Superior Court criminal trial. Does the record reflect that the judge told the jury at the end of each day and at the end of each day not to discuss the case with anyone else, but to only confer with the fellow jurors in the jury room, whatever the magic lingo is in this decade, and then ask every morning whether or not they had discussed the case with anyone else and got no positive answers?
That's correct. It was a one-day trial, during the breaks he did say that, and in fact the judge indicated in his decision he was disappointed that they didn't follow his instructions.
What was the reason? Well, when was the decision denying a new trial or mistrial?
January 16th, 09.
And when was the defendant sentenced?
He was sentenced, I believe, in April of 09. So, and that would account for why this is several, couple years later that we're here.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, James Wakely on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honors, this is not a case that fits within the presumptive prejudice category of juror misconduct. All of the cases that this court has decided on the egregious circumstances test are, the court used the phrase, clearly prejudicial, and all of those cases fit squarely within that.
Can you explain why the trial judge didn't make inquiry of any other jurors about the effect on them of the father's report of his son's expert testimony?
It's not clear on the record. The trial judge didn't state why he didn't. There was no request to interview any other jurors by either side. Juror number three.
But it is correct, he did not.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. Juror number three stated he did not communicate the substance of what his son told him to any other juror. He says that on page A51.
But didn't another juror say that he did?
Juror number three did say he told other jurors that he had talked with his son. Juror number two said that, yes, he said he talked with somebody about it. None of the other jurors that actually testified said that he communicated the substance of what the discussion with his son had been.
Well, they had to know why he was hung up on the verdict, though, didn't they, from the deliberations?
I believe juror number two testified, yes, that there was two of the jurors were hung up on the question of possession versus possession with intent.
So we're to believe that he didn't relate to any other juror who shared his concern about the verdict, the information that caused him to change his mind.
Your Honor, first, he testified specifically that did not change his mind. It was discussions in the jury room that changed his mind with other jurors.
Does the record reflect what made him so credible after he'd been disregarding the Superior Court judge's instructions throughout the trial?
Not particularly, Your Honor, but the trial judge did agree that his testimony was credible.
Did he say in his testimony that his son's testimony did not influence him that much?
I believe those were his words.
I said testimony, son's information.
His information. I believe that's what he did say, that it didn't help him very much, and that he remained confused the next day when he went back to the court.
Well, if he said that much, doesn't that acknowledge that it had some influence, however slight?
Your Honor, it could, or it could be a turn of the phrase. The fact is he went back into the jury room the next day, still unconvinced, as was found by the trial court, still unconvinced as to what verdict was appropriate, and after discussion with his fellow jurors, came to the conclusion that Mr. Black had committed possession with intent to distribute.
Well, with respect to the other jurors, at one point when the court asked juror number three whether he shared his information with the rest of the jury, he said, "I believe I mentioned it to the whole jury," and then said, "But I didn't go into exact words. I had mentioned to the jury that I had questions about drug addictions and stuff like that, and I had asked someone about drug addiction, but I didn't say exact words."
Yes, Your Honor. And then on page 51 of the appendix, it was, "Did you share with the jurors as you were sitting around the jury table exactly what your son and what he told you in response for whatever?" And juror number three replied, "No."
So he didn't tell them exactly what his son had said?
There's no indication. Obviously, there was no transcript. The trial judge believed that he did not communicate the information with the other jurors. None of the other jurors communicated anything of the sort to the trial judge when they were interviewed. Juror number one got it completely wrong. Juror number two didn't mention anything
but
about
a bunch of other jurors that we have no information about at all.
Yes, Your Honor.
And am I correct in understanding the record to be that the two or three people that were hung up that were causing the deliberations to go on for 2 days, we don't know that those were jurors number one, two, and three? In other words, the three jurors that the court actually interviewed aren't necessarily, juror number three is one of them, but we don't know that one and two are the other, quote, hung up jurors. It could have been juror number six and seven, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Juror number two from at least my understanding of the discussion with juror number one, was clearly on the side of conviction on possession with intent to distribute.
So he was not hung up on whether it was distribution for distribution or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that means we have to conclude that there are other jurors, from what juror number three told the court, there were other jurors who, like him, were not sure whether this should be just possession or possession with intent to distribute. And the court never attempted to speak to those others who were unsure, who later came back with a guilty verdict.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I believe that's – the judge did repeatedly refer to Rule 606B in doing the analysis here, and in an attempt to not delve further into the jury's processes, I believe, constrained his inquiry to what – the specific information that he had. And that's on the last page of the transcript from that section. He didn't want to go any further than he had to. There was no information that, as Ms. Walker said, this was essentially a game of telephone, identifying one person after another, and there was no indication that the chain went any further than juror number three.
Well, if I read appendix page 50 correctly, juror number three, the father of the outside expert witness, said he, quote, wasn't sure that Mr. Black was guilty of intent to deliver, close quote. His son provided him with information that if defendant possessed, quote, many different baggies, they're intending to sell it, close quote. And other members of the jury knew that juror number three was hung up over intent to deliver or simple possession, changed his vote, if he didn't say anything more than, based on information he had gotten from someone else, and then suddenly everybody votes to convict. That's the scenario, right?
Your Honor, I believe there were discussions in the morning, and what the juror number three said is it was the discussions with my fellow jurors that convinced me to vote in favor of possession with intent to distribute. That he was not influenced by his son, rather it was the discussions with his fellow jurors, as was appropriate, that allowed him to come to his decision.
But what's troubling me is he made this inquiry of his son, because his son was a recovering heroin addict, on the theory his son would know the quantity necessary to conclude, or at least have some idea of, the quantity that a user as opposed to a dealer would have. He asked that specific question. He gets a specific answer. And he claims in front of the judge who knows that no, it was the other juror's discussion with me that caused me to change my mind. How much sense does that make?
Your Honor, there was testimony on the record that the vast majority of the jurors were in favor of possession with intent to distribute, something along the line of 70% to 80% of the 12 members of the veneer. And it's entirely plausible that those jurors, rather than the word of his son that coincided with the state's case, were able to convince him. And the other jurors.
It's possible. I agree it's possible. But since he held out for a day, how probable is it until he had this information? How probable is it? Without asking the other jurors who were similarly situated what changed their mind. If all three had said, assuming juror number three plus two others who were hung, if all three had said, yeah, he told us that or said he talked to somebody outside the jury room, but that didn't influence the reason we changed our vote. It was the deliberations of the other eight or the other nine or whatever it may have been that convinced us to change our vote, then we wouldn't even have an issue. But that was never inquired into. So we don't know what the dynamic was.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, that goes back to,
should
I believe,
we be troubled by that?
Clearly the juror's conduct in this case is troubling. There's no question about that. However, the trial judge believed him when he said that he did not communicate it to the rest of the jury, believed him when he said it didn't influence his decision, and believed him when he said that it was the discussions with his fellow jurors that communicated. And this court, as it has repeatedly said, has great deference to the trial court in the evaluation of credibility on voir dire.
Yeah, if the trial judge inquires all of those whose credibility would be an issue. But did that happen here?
Your Honor, I believe it did. based on what the trial judge knew at the time and in deference to Rule 606B, didn't seek to inquire any further. There was no request to inquire any further. There was no information that would have led them to anybody other than these three jurors.
Did the trial judge impose any sanction or consider any sanction on juror number three for his violation of the instructions during the trial not to discuss the case with anyone?
There's nothing on the record if he did, Your Honor.
And when you say these three jurors were the only inquiry and that was sufficient, which three do you mean? Jurors number one, two, and three, or juror number three and the other two holdouts?
Jurors number one, two, and three, the ones that were actually inquired about on the record. Those were the identifiable jurors based on what was reported to the trial judge. It was juror number one who made the report, juror number two, the subject of juror number one's report, and juror number three.
Wouldn't you be more comfortable if the trial judge had said, now that I know the issue that held you up, juror number three, was deliver or simple possession, and the two others also did not vote the first day for guilt? Wouldn't you be more comfortable if the trial judge had said, I'm going to inquire of all of the jurors what was said in the jury room after juror number three admitted that he brought information to the entire jury from an extraneous source outside the courtroom, whatever and however he may have articulated it? The rest of the jury knew he changed his position. They had every reason to believe, potentially, that he changed it based on that outside information, even though he denied it later. Wouldn't you be more comfortable if the trial judge found out whether, in fact, it was further deliberations that changed everybody's mind and not the turn about by juror number three?
Absolutely, Your Honor, except that is precisely what is forbidden by 606B. Cannot inquire into the mental processes by which they came to their conclusion. Unfortunately, this is a rule created black hole.
I accept that's a good point. You're correct about entering into their mental processes. But isn't there an exception to that when part of the mental process is driven by extraneous evidence brought by one juror who's violated the court's instructions not to discuss the case with anyone outside the courtroom, and then when asked if he did, denied it, or at least didn't respond that in fact he had, until he was in effect ratted out by a fellow juror later in the day? Isn't that an exception?
It is, and that was the scope of the inquiry conducted by the trial court. It was, to the extent that the trial court was able to determine this information was communicated, the trial judge interviewed the jurors. He was the limited scope of jurors that he was able to identify.
Okay. One of the things that at least I see with regard to juror misconduct now is the potential for texting, internet research, using technology to find additional information during the course of a trial. And I know that instructions are being given more and more expressly on that. Are instructions like that being given in the Superior Court and the trial courts today?
I believe so, but I can't speak with certainty on it. I would hope so, Your Honor.
Are the rule that is cited in the briefs in terms of how these issues are analyzed, is that sufficient in the times of these texting and internet research and other issues? In other words, has times changed enough for that rule to be reexamined, or from your position, is that rule appropriate still?
Your Honor, the state's position is the rule is still appropriate. It lays out a very clear dividing line as to what is presumptively prejudicial, what is not, and what needs to be established one way or another under either rubric. Certainly, if the jurors at issue in Flannery had come to that information by way of the internet, that would still fit within the presumptively prejudicial box. Same with the jurors in Robert Ashley. It's a new method, but it's the same misconduct. and there's really no need to revise the rule or to reconsider the rule, because the issues that those rules were concerned with are the same. There's just now more ways to do it.
Right, and the current rule refers to it being identifiably prejudiced. And what, again, is your position as to whether or not the admission did not influence me much, assuming that's, in essence, what he said? Why isn't that identifiable prejudice?
And it goes back, Your Honor, to the statement from juror number three that it was the discussions, the deliberations with his fellow jurors that came to his, that he came to his conclusion. That is, there is no prejudice because he said, based on what we discussed during jury deliberations, I came to the conclusion that he was guilty of possession with intent to distribute.
All right.
If there's no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Excuse me, 2 points. One, 606B, Chief Justice Steele, you are correct. It specifically carves out an exception whenever there's outside influence is improperly brought to bear upon any juror, then inquiry can be made into the processes with respect to at least to that misconduct. With respect to the Flannery case, I would also point out that jurors testified that they were not affected by what they had heard, and yet the court concluded two things. One, there was actual prejudice, and in different circumstances, there was presumptive prejudice, and reversed that case. And finally, juror number two was not one of the ones that was hung, but she did provide something that was very insightful. She said they had to go around the table three or four times before they quit deliberating for the day, and they went home. And then as the juror number three indicated, he did say that my son did not help me much. And he did actually communicate substantive facts to him, because the son's response was, if they have that many baggies, then it is for sale. And interestingly, the son was a heroin addict, and they were dealing with crack here, so they may have also unduly granted him some kind of expert status that he did not deserve. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.